This afternoon's case is United States v. Norwood. Appellant ready to argue?
Yes, Your Honor.
Government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Appellant may argue.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court. I'm Lieutenant Commander Chris Riedel, and I represent Machinist Mate Nuclear First Class Matthew Norwood.
Could you speak up a little?
Yes, Your Honor. Respectfully request to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, sir.
Granted.
Thank you. Repetition creates the illusion of credibility, but mere repetition does not imply a statement is true. This Court should order a new trial in this case because, first, the alleged victim's entire forensic interview was improperly admitted under MRE 801 D1B, allowing mere repetitions of her allegations to stand in for her credibility. And second, the government improperly bolstered this illusion of credibility by vouching for the victim's truthfulness and repeatedly smearing Petty Officer Norwood as a child molester. Under MRE 801 D1B, there are two clauses. Here, the government offered at trial the entire forensic interview under B2, and the military judge at trial accepted it under B2. That was inappropriate because, as this Court pointed out in Finch, under B2, it has to go directly to rehabilitating the victim's credibility, and the entire interview did not do that. There were only select statements of allegations here based on the cross-examination that would have allowed minor portions of that interview to come in. For example, the defense attacked her on the other ground of, hey, you've added a new fact here, and therefore, when they were incorrect about that, and she had actually stated that new fact, that small portion of the interview would have come in. But the entire forensic interview was improper bolstering because the defense didn't attack her entire statement on the stand.
Wasn't the defense theory that she was making it up or coached or something like that?
Your Honor, that's what the government had said that they had alleged coaching, but that wasn't the defense's theory that she was coached. It was just that she made it up, Your Honor.
She made it up.
Yes,
okay,
Your Honor.
Out of whole cloth.
Yes, Your Honor. And
okay, well then, isn't the whole thing fair game when you're saying she's a liar and they're trying to put this in to rehab her? Isn't that pretty much fair game?
No, Your Honor.
For the government.
No, Your Honor, because every cross-examination attacks witnesses as lying, and just the
every cross-examination doesn't attack witnesses as lying. But some do. Go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor. In those situations where the defense attacks as lying, they're not opening the door to every prior consistent statement because merely saying that what they're saying is false doesn't bring in a repetitive statement from before, Your Honor, doesn't rehabilitate that accusation that it was false because that's just relying on the mere repetition alone. Whereas for specific attacks, there is a rehabilitative potential for prior statements, which is what this Court recognized in Finch, Your Honor, is that when the specific state prior statement is consistent and directly addresses a specific ground of attack, that may be true. So if the defense had said you're lying about this because of something that happened yesterday, but they have a statement that was from 3 days ago, then that would perhaps answer it. But if the statement is, oh, you're making this up, you're adding a new fact, that doesn't necessarily rehabilitate just because she has said something in the past, Your Honor.
So let me try to tease that out a little bit so we can have a better grasp of your argument. First off, it's your position that this was not prosecutorial coaching, that it was instead an allegation that the witness made this up on her own?
Yes, Your Honor. And the specific allegation that was done on cross-examination is that she was adding new facts and not that she was being coached into adding those new facts, not that the government told her those new facts, but just that she added those new facts.
So when the question was, when did you remember that? Yesterday when you were practicing your testimony, and it's implicit in there with the prosecutors, it's still your position that was not prosecutorial coaching, that it was she was creating this wholesale on her own.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that if you read those in a vacuum and you just focus at those questions, you can see how the military judge got there in the sense of saying, oh, this question alone appears to imply coaching. But that's why you're supposed to look at, this court has said in, in Frost that you look at the entire circumstances of it, Your Honor. So it's in context. So what would the members have actually believed was going on here? Not an implication that she was coached into adding this. It was merely to establish that that new fact was added recently,
so
not at the implication of the government.
Then why does the government not have the opportunity to put in the statement, the prior statement, to point out that she was never asked a question that would have elicited that testimony, or it was not something that would have come up in the course of her telling the investigators about what had occurred?
Your Honor, they may have been able to cross-examine that, or on redirect they may have been able to ask her that question, is, were you asked this question? And she could say no. But putting in the entire interview to prove that what she said isn't admissible, unless the defense was to stand back up and be like, you're lying, you were asked that question. But in this case, there were a few facts that she added where there was specific statements in the interview. So, for instance, the discussion about did you have a boyfriend back home? The defense attacks her on that, and she says on the stand, she answers the question, and then the defense alleges that her answer on the stand was inconsistent. That was not true. She actually did, in fact, not omit that during the forensic interview. So that small portion of the forensic interview is a direct refutation of that cross-examination of the addition of a new fact. But only that small portion. The fact that the rest of her interview comes in to rebut that small attack, that's the inappropriate admission, where the defense never alleges that she made up the allegation that Petty Officer Norwood touched her recently. They say that she made that up from the beginning, and so therefore the forensic interview isn't actually rebutting that allegation. It's just allowing the members to take it back and repeatedly see her say it, Your Honor.
Counsel, may I ask you a question about what was the defense's challenge to her credibility? I understand that your position was they were challenged her credibility right from the start so that no consistent statements could come in. Can you explain to me what was the defense strategy to challenge her credibility from the very start? And the reason I ask this is to try to assess what the prejudice might be of admitting the entire statement. You point out that by admitting the entire statement, when portions of it, in your view, were not admissible, it bolstered her credibility. But my question is, in which ways was her credibility challenged?
So the main challenges to her credibility, Your Honor, was that she refused to meet with defense and was hiding something, and that her statement as a whole was incredible based on the fact that her brother was there the whole time. And that's the real countervailing evidence here, is that what should have happened at trial was a weighing of her statements versus her brother's, as opposed to what happened here, where it wasn't just what she said at trial versus her brother's explanation that nothing happened, as a person who was there in the room and should have been able to see something in theory. And instead, the members, all they had was the one time her brother testified on the stand, but they got to take back into the room her statement over and over again, and so they could repeatedly watch that. And that's where the prejudice attaches, is that it's no longer a weighing of the credibility of the witnesses supported by admissible evidence. It's her credibility becomes astronomically more supported by the fact that they can just watch her say the same things over and over again, Your Honor.
Thank you. Can I ask an unrelated question, which is, I believe the military judge determined as the predicate for allowing it in, the evidence in, that there was coaching, and you disagree with it. Do we review that under a clear error standard?
No, Your Honor, I believe that that's de novo in that sense, in the sense that the defense did object at trial that it wasn't coaching, and that is a determination of law, not of fact, in the sense that it's not a determination of fact that he coached. It's a determination that coaching is a recent fabrication. So if this court agreed with the military judge that it coached, it would be a allegation of a recent fabrication, and that's, I don't think, a determination of fact by the military judge. It's a application of the law.
So we owe the judge no deference?
Not on that. And I think in this case, Your Honor, there should be no deference to the military judge, because the military judge clearly conflated MRE 801 D1B 1 and 2, because 1 is where coaching would fall. So if the military judge was accurate to determine that this whole thing was coaching, that he applied coaching of the whole statement, then it should have been under B1. But the military judge brought it in under B2, showing that the military judge completely conflated the application of the law and this court shouldn't give him any deference on whether it was coaching or was not, and should read that in the whole context of the case, Your Honor.
Thank you.
You started talking about prejudice, essentially, in terms of the video going back with the panel members and they could watch it over and over. In terms of this court conducting its prejudice analysis, you indicated in your brief that the defense case was strong, the defense case. Could you articulate more about why it was a strong case?
Yes, Your Honor. So had this case not taken that left turn, so if you imagine that the members go back, and what they have is her statements on the stand, bolstered by merely small portions of consistency, but some of her statements not bolstered because there was no consistent prior statement. And then they're weighing the other evidence, and then basically it becomes, does the members believe her, or do they believe her brother's theory that nothing happened, it was a normal trip, the late report? There's not a ton of other consistency. As you see in the defense closing, Your Honor, they point out that the statements of the victim's mother contradicted her in ways, so she didn't tell the same story. They had an other reasonable explanation for what the government alleged was consciousness of guilt phone call. So they had explanations for all of that. And if the members had taken that back and weighed that, then it's a fair balance of weighing a true assessment of credibility of the witnesses. Whereas here, by admitting the entire interview, that's a substantial portion of evidence that was the judge specifically told them they could use for the truth of the matter asserted in that interview, basically allowing them to weigh this video that they have back to repeatedly watch against their memories of what other witnesses said. And that's where the prejudice accrues and the unfairness of the process in that sense, Your Honor.
So the prejudice was exacerbated by the fact that the military judge let it in under two, meaning then it became substantive evidence? Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. Whether the judge let it in under 2 or 1, the fact that the judge let it in under 801 D1B, either one, it comes in as substantive, and then he instructs the members, you can use this as substantive, and then they're given the video. So it's not just they see her the statements. She doesn't read from a transcript on the stand saying, yes, I said this before. They actually take this video. And this video is a child forensic interview as well, Your Honor, exacerbating the fact that this isn't the police, this isn't a situation. This is a child forensic interview, very hands-off, very different from what the true assessment of credibility here would be, which is, what did she say on the stand? How did she appear on the stand? Basically substituting the member's judgment of that credibility for watching the video over and over again.
Wasn't the brother's testimony somewhat impeached, though, in terms of his lack of attention? He was focused on video games and so forth?
Certainly, Your Honor. The government attacked his memory of the situation in much the same way that the defense attacked her statement as not being realistic, and in the sense that she wasn't just attacked for adding new facts, she was also attacked for, you had an opportunity to report this, you had your cell phone, you were in contact with your mom the whole time, you didn't even tell your parents when you got back. So there was lots of other attacks on the reasonableness of the whole story, and the government had their case. The problem here is the left turn away from that actual balancing of the cases, the providency of the jury to weigh, hey, whose evidence really is stronger here? Does it go beyond a reasonable doubt? Gets pulled off into left field by this video that they just watch over and over again and are told that by watching it, you can just take that as truth, Your Honor.
Now, you keep saying they watch it over and over again. Is that in the record?
There's no way to know how many times they watched it. It's more of the fact that they just take it back, Your Honor, and can be assumed that they watch it.
Would you please address the second issue?
Yes, Your Honor. So, similar to this court's ruling in Voorhees, which the lower court didn't address the similarities of Voorhees, the government here in closing repeatedly just says she's telling you the truth, you know it's the truth, it's not a fabrication, it's not a lie, it's the truth, you know it's the truth. And that kind of wholesale example of, hey, just believe her, is extremely exacerbated in this case because they're not just referring to what she said on the stand. They're basically saying, go back and watch that video. It's the truth. Watch the video. It's the truth. And that sort of turn in the left field sort of brings the government's argument to not just that they're vouching on the offhand vouching for what the victim said on the stands. They're saying, hey, you can trust her. She told the truth, without explaining why she told the truth. Certainly in parts of their closing they do it correctly, but the repeated assertions that she told the truth over and over again is asserting that she's telling the truth and they should just believe her just because she's telling the truth, not for back.
Well, yeah, get away from the video. What about the government? What about the trial counsel saying, "You guys couldn't show your faces if you don't convict this guy"?
That is also, other than that, yes, that is the other aspect that is very concerning, is this idea that the government couches the defense's theory as basically being child molesters can't be convicted,
yeah,
as opposed to making it fact-specific to this scenario, because the defense was certainly alleging that the victim here isn't telling the truth, but in no way did the defense ever say that victims as a whole are not telling the truth. It was very couched to this specific victim, don't believe her because look at her brother says, look at how the story doesn't make sense. Whereas the government made it about a broad assertion of, hey, if you don't convict here, you can't convict any child molester ever. And that sort of put pressure
on. Well, and it's more than that, that you're shamed publicly among members of your service because you let this guy go. Isn't that basically what he said?
Yes, Your Honor. And they continue that into the sentencing argument later, sir. That
But defense counsel just sat there.
Yes, Your Honor, the defense
counsel just sat there. There's no allegation of IAC here. Defense counsel just sat there. The judge just sat there. And in it went. Ultimately, we have to find prejudice. And this is pretty egregious, but look at the sentence.
Yes, Your Honor, and I don't think that based on case law and based on the circumstances here, that prejudice necessarily accrues compared to previous cases. For example, in Voorhees, it's similar conduct, and this court didn't find prejudice in Voorhees. And that's true. It's the interplay between the misconduct by the prosecutor, the emphasizing it, and on top of basically using the inappropriately admissible evidence, and it's the stacking that really gets us over that line. Whereas Voorhees didn't make it to that just on the statements alone. It's the statements referencing the inappropriately admitted evidence.
Now, are you saying that under our case law, we couldn't find prejudice by this stuff?
No, Your Honor.
What are you saying? Go ahead, answer the question.
Thank you, Your Honor. No, I'm not saying that you couldn't find prejudice. I'm saying I could see why the court might not. I believe there was prejudice here in the sense that the distraction by making this about all sex offenders and basically putting a public onus on the members to find him is the type of prejudice that should cross the line, and this court should find that in reverse. But if they chose not to, the distinction from this in Voorhees is not just that there was prosecutorial misconduct, but it was prosecutorial misconduct on top of inappropriately admitted evidence and the government making this left turn into this video and then trying to drag the members into using that video as like the mainstay of convicting.
Okay, one technical question. How long was the video?
The video was about 55 minutes, Your Honor, but the judge cut out a substantial portion of it for the repertoire building. So I timed it at about 35 to 40 minutes.
And how long, do you know how long the members were out?
I do not know off the top of my head, Your Honor, no.
Chief Judge, may I ask, even though time has expired, because I'd like to read to you the sentence on argument by the government.
Yes.
It said, I want you to think about tomorrow when you all return to your normal duties. You get back to work and someone asks where you've been this week. You tell them that you had a court-martial duty and you tell them the facts of this case. You tell them that you convicted a first-class petty officer of molesting his 15-year-old niece. The person you're telling this to is going to turn to you and they're going to ask, wow, what did he get for that? You did not argue, no one argued below, that this was injecting the command into the deliberation room. Is there any reason for that? Seems to me that there was no limitation here to peers, that you're saying you're going back to the work site and everybody's going to be asking you what you did for a sentence. That would include supervisors and commanders and so forth. I'm just wondering whether there is a UCI issue out there that's not been raised by you.
Your Honor, I had not considered the UCI mostly because the way I read that was that it was focused on peers or junior sailors in that sense. But I could certainly, as you couch it now, I could see how you could get to UCI, Your Honor, in that sense.
Well, I'm not going to raise it for you. I'm just wondering if there was some reason that was not apparent on the record why you did not raise it in terms of a factual reason rather than a legal reason. Thank you, Chief Judge.
Chief Judge, if I could follow up on that.
Oh, go ahead.
Do you have any particular authority that you might lead us to in terms of not just military cases but civilian cases when a jury is asked to consider how a verdict will reflect on them personally in the community?
Your Honor, I did not see any specific ones that I could think of off the top of my head that reflected that.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for the government.
Good afternoon, Chief Judge Stuckey, and may it please the Court. I'm Major Carrie Friedewald, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Nick Gannon, we represent the United States. This Court should affirm for two reasons. First, the military judge's legal error in admitting the entire interview was harmless because the record supports a permissible alternative basis for its admission. And second, trial counsel's arguments were neither improper nor prejudicial. To the first issue, this Court reviews a military judge's admission of evidence for an abuse of discretion. The lower court here found that the military judge abused his discretion as a matter of law by characterizing an allegation of coaching as an attack on another ground under 801D1B2. This Court confirmed in Finch that that was the appropriate holding. An attack on another ground must include something other than the grounds enumerated in B1. And as this Court found in Allison, an allegation of coaching by the prosecution is a recent improper influence that implicates B1. And Judge Maggs, to your question, the government believes that the military judge's finding that the cross-examination alleged coaching is a finding of fact that this Court should review for clear error. As appellant himself analogized this to Frost, this is like the military judge's finding in Frost that the appellant's cross-examination alleged a recent improper influence at a certain date. Here, the finding is similarly factual, that the military judge looked at the questions posed on cross-examination and found that they alleged that the prosecution coached this victim. And as such, this Court should review that finding for clear error. The military judge here did not clearly err. As the text of B1 says, the charge of recent improper influence can be express or implied. The Third Circuit in Frazier looked at that express and implied language in the federal rule and found that a recent improper influence is implied when there is a suggestion that the victim's testimony or the witness's testimony has been consciously altered as a result of that recent influence. Here, appellant's cross-examination more than implied that the victim's testimony changed as a result of her preparation with the prosecutors.
Well, appellate defense counsel's point is that that may be, but it didn't require the whole interview to come in. Isn't that what his claim is?
That's part of it, Your Honor. The whole interview was implicated here because the appellant's counsel began his cross-examination not simply by establishing that the victim had not spoken to appellant's counsel like he did with the other government witnesses. He went further and asked about her, how long she had prepared with prosecutors, what questions they asked her, and whether she had told the truth and whether she'd ever had to practice to tell the truth. And, Your Honor, what implicates the entirety of her testimony and thus the entirety of the interview is where on Joint Appendix 95, he circles back to that theme later in her cross and says when he's confronted her with an omission from that interview, did you only remember that after practicing with the prosecutors? The implication there, as the military judge found, the implication there in the members' minds are there other parts of her testimony that have changed as a result of practicing all of her questions for an hour and a half with the prosecutors the day before? And, Your Honor, the military judge conducted a 403 balancing test. He had previously watched the entire video, and he found, balancing the factors under 403, that the entirety of the video was admissible to rehabilitate her based on that attack on another ground. So, as the lower court noted, he certainly assessed the rehabilitative value under B2, but it was for the same factual finding that she was alleged to have been coached by the prosecution. So, Your Honor, that's why the entirety of the interview was admissible based on the allegation of coaching.
Why hadn't she already been adequately rehabilitated by the questioning focusing on, well, you were never asked that question, were you, and so forth.
Your Honor, the government has the burden of proof at trial, and while they certainly asked her those questions, their very first question on redirect was about trying to rehabilitate her, about the trial prep. The government has the burden to prove that the victim here has been consistent and that her testimony is credible, and so the government was not restricted by those questions from further offering under 801D1B.
Why wouldn't that swallow the whole purpose of the rule, though? The approach that you're articulating right now, it would seem as if there's some little small thing out there, bam, the government gets to open the door completely with a prior consistent statement. Isn't that what we said you cannot do?
Your Honor, that's what this court said you cannot do under B2. And that was the focus in this court's holding in Finch, that under B2, you can't drive a truck through the rule and take a single impeachment on an inconsistency or an omission and bring in an entire statement. But here, the function of B1, when rebutting a charge of a recent improper influence, this court has long held in McCaskey and Allison, and as the lower court found, B1 must function to rehabilitate the entirety of the alleged influence. And here, the appellant's cross-examination touched on her entire preparation with prosecutors, all of the questions, and left the implication that her entire testimony was embellished or shaped with the help of the prosecutors.
Now, where do you get that from, that her entire testimony was embellished? It seemed as if defense counsel was only touching on a couple of ancillary points. And that's my concern that I've raised to you about, wouldn't we be throwing the door wide open if defense counsel touched on a couple of ancillary points, and if we were to adopt the government's position where even under B1, the entire prior consistent statement should come in?
Your Honor, the government believes that here on these facts and based on appellant's cross-examination here, in addition to the small points he impeached her on for the inconsistencies and omissions, his line of questioning regarding her trial preparation impacted more than just those inconsistencies and omissions. The government would grant that possibly under B1, not in every case, would and the entire interview be admissible, Your Honor.
But if the defense has, or the government has already had an opportunity to rehabilitate right off the bat, as you said, how does that new statement pass the 403B balancing test in terms of it being cumulative, wasting time, undue delay, and so forth?
Well, Your Honor, that's a factual, that's a determination left to the province of the military judge, and the military judge did that here. He conducted the full 403 balancing test, and because he had watched the entire interview, he knew that it was generally consistent with her trial testimony and that it would function to rehabilitate her credibility.
And what standard of review does this court use in looking at a balancing test
done by a military judge? Your Honor, this court would give that 403 ruling substantial deference under Mann's because it was fully articulated on the record. Certainly, given he assessed the rehabilitative credibility under B2, it was for the not clearly erroneous finding nonetheless.
If the military judge made an error in terms of what prong it should come in, does that matter about any deference we should give the 403 balancing test?
Your Honor, the government doesn't believe so. The 403 balancing test is about the quality of the evidence specifically at issue, and the military judge did not clearly err when he found that coaching had been alleged. So, yes, he wrapped it around the wrong prong of 801D1B, but he was nonetheless looking at it for the right reason. And regardless of whether the entire interview was admissible, appellant suffered no prejudice under the Kerr factors. The government's case here was strong. The victim's testimony was bolstered by the evidence of appellant's consciousness of guilt. In comparison, appellant's case was weak. He could not point to...
Now, what about the defense contention that they adequately explained the statements to the mother and to the brother of appellant in the course of the case? What's the government's position on that?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. The mother's statements?
The statement was made that by defense counsel that those points were adequately addressed by the defense during the court-martial? What's the government's position on that?
Your Honor, the government's position is that the appellant, he relied on the testimony of the victim's younger brother, who, as Judge Olson, I believe you pointed out, had significant impeachment against him and faulty memory issues. He was only 12 at the time of the trip. He couldn't remember what time of year this New Year's Eve trip took place, and he admitted to playing video games in appellant's bedroom where he couldn't see the living room.
I'm focusing more on the strange statements made to the father.
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor. I misinterpreted.
I probably misled you. When I was talking about the brother of the appellant,
yes,
not the brother of the victim. They were strange statements that were made by appellant to his brother, to the mother of the victim. The defense position is that those were adequately addressed in the course of the court-martial. What's the government's position on that?
Your Honor, the government doesn't believe that. So appellant brought forward his brother's wife or soon-to-be ex-wife to say that that strange phone call might have been about Facebook messages he sent to her. That the government's position is that simply was not a credible theory, that this strange conversation, as I believe you termed it, Your Honor, would have arisen from Facebook messages like that. And to the materiality and quality of the evidence, as appellant himself admits, this was mere repetition. And as this court in McCaskey said, mere repetition does not add to anything the truth of the testimony at trial. So she could have been consistent in a fabrication. Appellant nonetheless could not bring forward any reason for her to have fabricated. So under the Kerr factors, there was no prejudice here.
Would you address the second issue,
please? Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, in addressing that, would you address the relationship between the comment that trial counsel made about how coworkers would feel about the matters that took place at the court-martial and how the court members would explain to their coworkers what happened in the context of Military Rule of Evidence 509, which involves the privilege of deliberations, court members? And also address it in terms of one of the justifications that's been given for non-unanimous rulings in courts martial, so that no court martial member in a non-capital case can be identified with a particular ruling.
Yes, Your Honor. Your Honor, the government's position is that we do not believe the way she posed this thought experiment invaded the secrecy of the deliberations. And the military judge on record site 658, he did instruct the members that, granted this was at the close of the court-martial, that their deliberations are secret and that they cannot reveal their votes on any matter. So, Your Honor, the government's position is that...
How does that fit in with the trial counsel, who's the representative of the government, saying, how are you going to explain this to your coworkers?
So, Your Honor, the way she posed this thought experiment was asking them how they might explain that the appellant was awarded no punishment. So we look at it as had the resulting punishment been no punishment, this question would not have necessarily posed, well, what did you vote for? What punishment did you want? It's merely the result of the court-martial. So it would be akin to simply telling someone the result of the court-martial, but not necessarily how they voted on that matter, Your Honor. And in that sense, the government believes that train of argument there on Joint Appendix 206 to 207 was from the perspective of the receiver. So the receiver of the message of what the sentence was.
Because was it that plain error for the judge not to immediately interject and say that was an improper comment because it implied that they would have to explain?
Your Honor, to the extent that it invades the secrecy of deliberations, it could be plain error. The government's position is that's simply not how we read her argument, Your Honor. And the government's position is that sentencing argument was a general deterrence message. Looking at that portion in the paragraph, she ends it by saying that the sentence you respond with, meaning the sentence that is imposed, should send that general deterrence message. And she's arguing that a sentence of no punishment does not serve a general deterrent purpose.
It's not couched in terms of no punishments. It's couched in terms of, wow, nothing, well, nothing at all. That could be anything from, you know, a small sentence that seems to the average person disproportionate to the offense. I mean, isn't this wholly improper? And then nothing happens. Defense counsel sits there. The judge sits there. And so what are we to make of this? You know, you don't do that. That's wholly improper. I disagree with your general deterrence formulation, because this is directed directly at the members, and she's telling them that if you don't hammer this guy, this child molester, because you just referred to him as a child molester, if you don't hammer this child molester, you will not be able to hold your head up in the service with your fellow members. Now, I can't imagine anything more grossly improper. What's the government say about that?
Your Honor, the prosecutor made two references to what we believe is the general deterrence message. The first was the alleged improper argument here, where she is talking about it, and if you look at 206, where she poses as this thought experiment about awarding no punishment. She later, in her argument, comes back to the general deterrence message and argues in favor of her requested punishment of 4 years confinement and a dishonorable discharge, and argues that that is the appropriate punishment to send the general deterrent message. So, Your Honor, looking at it in context, she makes this argument in context of not awarding no punishment.
Well, is she saying if he doesn't get 4 years in a DD, you guys are shamed forever? What's she saying?
Your Honor, she's saying two things, that appellant's crime deserves punishment and that he should not receive no punishment. And second, she's saying that an award of no punishment serves no general deterrent purpose. But, Your Honor, certainly understanding your position, the appellant was nonetheless not prejudiced by this argument.
Why was he not?
The third Fletcher factor is dispositive here, Your Honor.
Yep.
The third Fletcher factor is dispositive.
Yeah.
The weight of the evidence in sentencing and the weight of the evidence presented on findings supports the sentence awarded here, which was 18 months of confinement and a dishonorable discharge. The government asked for 4 years and a DD, and appellant himself asked for 12 months confinement and no discharge. This court has previously looked to the range of punishments offered and looked to see where the actual sentence was arrived to find that there was no prejudice. And here he received less than half what the government asked for. So, Your Honor, that the government believes here that that's dispositive of why there was no prejudice from this argument.
Okay, but you said the defense asked for no discharge of any sort.
Yes, Your Honor.
So the argument that was posed by the government counsel was, do you really want your answer to be nothing at all? Will you be comfortable telling them that the accused is back at work as though nothing ever happened? What if he returns to work tomorrow, having been convicted by a court-martial? So essentially you're saying you must impose at a minimum a BCD. And, in fact, they did. So why doesn't that go to the chief judge's point about how damaging this is?
Well, Your Honor, I would again point to the third Fletcher factor, that the strength of the government evidence here. This was a man convicted of sexually abusing his 15-year-old niece. A dishonorable discharge is appropriate for that evidence and that conviction. This argument had no impact on the members' award of that discharge, since it was appropriate for the crime and the evidence before them.
So from your perspective, then, we should be looking not at the quality of the evidence of the conviction, but the conviction itself? I just want to be clear on that.
Both, Your Honor.
So couldn't it be looked at as this is a one witness case for the government? There's no forensic evidence. The allegation was somewhat stale when it was made. Is that really a strong case that the government has?
Yes, Your Honor, it is. And to your point that the allegation was somewhat stale, the government did present expert testimony in child forensic psychology explaining that delayed reports are common. And notably, the appellant put forward no motive for the victim here to lie, unlike in Frost and in Finch, where there was motive about you know, custody battles and where they want to live, that significantly undermined the victims in those cases.
If we were to take that element out, a motive to fabricate, if you've got a case where it's just the victim, and I'm not saying that that isn't sufficient in many instances, don't get me wrong, but if we've got just the victim and no forensic evidence, no other witnesses, no admissions, no confessions by the accused, what would we have in terms of a weaker case than that?
Your Honor, one in which the victim had made denials or recantations, like the victim in Frost. Here, this was a victim who provided credible testimony at trial, and that was found to be consistent after she was alleged to have been coached. And there was, and Your Honor, I'll reiterate again, as you term them, the strange discussions he had with the mother and his brother that showed that he was exhibiting a consciousness of guilt. And I'm sorry, I see my time
has
expired.
Go ahead, answer the question.
So, Your Honor, here, that is why the government believes that the appellant's case was strong here. I'm sorry, the government's case was strong here.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Here, this was a one-witness case in which the government turned cross-examination into a minefield that allowed the government to drive a semi-truck through the prohibitions on hearsay, basically allowing the one key witness, the main factor here, to be improperly bolstered by letting that video, the entire video, not just the parts that directly addressed the cross-examination, go back and be repeatedly watched and stand in as truth because it was repeated. And we're instructed that they could consider that video.
We don't know that it was repeatedly watched. We don't know how long they were out.
Yes, Your Honor.
You keep saying it was repeatedly watched, but we don't know that, do we?
It may have only been watched the extra time. They were back there enough to watch it. They had the equipment to watch it, and they watched it at least one additional time in the courtroom when the government played it, Your Honor. So they got to see her testimony.
They got to see it twice.
So at a minimum, Your Honor.
That's what we know.
So yes, how damaging is that, though? There was a significant period of time between when she was first interviewed and the videotape was made, and then when she testified at the court-martial. Her testimony was very consistent. There were only these minor anomalous discrepancies. Wouldn't it be much more compelling for panel members to have a live human being saying, this is what happened to me, as compared to a stale videotape where essentially she's saying the exact same thing she just said in person? Why is that so damaging to the defense?
Your Honor, I think it's because it's that appearance of consistency that creates the illusion that the defense's claim that she's making it up becomes more ridiculous. And as when...
Wait a minute, pass that by me again. What?
So It's damaging, Your Honor, in the sense that it creates the illusion that she may very well have been very credible on the stand, and we can't really tell that here because we don't have a video of how she appeared on the stand. And so the members were supposed to judge her credibility on the stand, and perhaps she is extremely credible on the stand, but we can't know that. That judgment was replaced by this video to create the illusion that she has repeated the statement multiple times. In that repetition alone makes it seem like she's less likely to be lying. And that's where the prejudice is because it's not a test of her credibility any longer on the stand. It's just she said it before and she's saying it now. It must be true. And that's an illusion of credibility, not addressing an actual attack on her thing. And as the defense said on its Joint Appendix 117, Your Honor, when the judge was about to admit this, is that it was ridiculous to assume that they were saying that she had been coached in her entirety, in the sense that allegation from the defense that the prosecutors brought her in the day before and coached her entire testimony was ridiculous because no defense would allege that in that sense, in the sense that it didn't make sense to allege that here because the fact of the matter was they were alleging no, this was fabricated from the get-go, and her story just doesn't make sense on its face. Not that she's being told by the prosecutors to fabricate it, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Court thanks counsel for both sides. The case is now submitted. Court is in recess until 09:30 tomorrow.